If someone wants to go out and trap or shoot a wolf, they should be able to do that unencumbered.
The State Game Board looks at the controversial Denali Wolves issue. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 26th of February. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Juno kids adjust to life without the Boys and Girls Club.
There was a lot of other stuff we could do there, like we would have friends, we would have art activities.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The State Game Board is taking up the contentious issue of Denali wolves that roam outside the park boundaries and are vulnerable to hunting and trapping. The board convened a 10-day meeting in Fairbanks today on a range of interior issues, including the Denali wolf buffer. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the board is considering proposals to increase, shrink, or eliminate the protective buffer.
The Denali Wolf Buffer was created a decade ago and expanded to its current 92 square miles along the park's northeastern edges in 2004. At the time, the board also imposed a six-year moratorium on dealing with the issue because it was drawing many proposals and sapping board energy. 6 years later, time is up. The buffer along the park's highway and Stampede Road is scheduled to sunset, and forces are mobilized on both sides to debate its future. Healy area hunting guide and trapper Coke Wallace says, as the wolves are a state resource and Alaskans should be able to hunt or trap them.
They're on state land, they're a state animal, and actually the resources belong to all of us, everyone in this state. And if someone wants to go out and trap or shoot a wolf, as long as they're following the seasons and they have a hunting or trapping license, they should be able to do that unencumbered.
Wallace says the current buffer infringes on prime trapping along the Savage and Teklanika rivers, and not just for wolves.
Since that buffer zone has come in, I haven't been doing lynx and wolverine sets I'd like to be doing west of the Savage River out towards the Tek and prime wolverine and lynx country for fear of catching a wolf in a set.
The interest of trappers and hunters are up against local and lower 48 wildlife advocates who have long pushed for a larger buffer to better protect park wolves popular with Denali visitors. Connecticut-based Friends of Animals president Priscilla Farrell says park wolves should not be hunted or trapped.
You know, the upshot of all of this, of course, is fur rust, something that you put around your parka. And one wolf can provide five of those fur roughs. It seems like a terrible waste.
On a more local front, the Denali Citizens Council also supports a bigger buffer and has a proposal before the board. DCC President Nancy Bale says increased protection is needed because the wolf packs that frequent the park's northeastern corner are shrinking.
Population has gone down to about 65 individuals from 110 just a year and a half ago. And park studies have shown that the role of human-caused mortality has grown over those same years. So we're hoping to increase the odds of the wolves surviving.
The National Park Service has long been neutral on the issue, but the declining population data, as well as wolves seen dragging broken traps and snares in the park, have swayed NPS officials to submit their own proposal for increasing the buffer. Denali National Park spokeswoman Chris Pfister says the concern is about having wolves for visitors to see.
A viewable wildlife issue and an allocation issue. It's not a population issue, but basically we're hoping to work with the state to determine what is the best use for essentially these wolves.
Fish and Game spokeswoman Kathy Harms says the buffer dispute comes down to values.
Consequently, the department's recommendation is going to be no recommendation. The board can hammer this out with people with a variety of different views.
One voice is noticeably absent from the renewed wolf buffer debate, wildlife scientist and activist Gordon Haber, who studied Denali wolves for decades, was killed in a plane crash while tracking them in the park last fall. Some of the buffer increase proposals cite Haber research that showed social and behavioral impacts to wolf family groups when individual animals are killed. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska Congressman Don Young has signed on to a letter with other House Republicans demanding more information about a leaked Interior Department report. The draft internal report came to light last week. It lists places in the nation potentially worthy of federal protection and includes two Alaska locations, Bristol Bay and Teshakpuk Lake, in the Western Arctic. The Interior Department says the report was just the result of brainstorming and no decisions have been made, but Representative Young and others are crying foul and say they want more information about the Interior Department's intentions and whether they plan to try and protect the areas with monument designations.
I want to put it writing that they're not going to put those in monuments, because then we got a court battle. And I don't think they can do it. I think we'll win in court. So, I hope that they have the wisdom to write back. So this was a staff effort and it was really vetted, and we realize that we can't do this.
Young says the Interior Department can't act without congressional approval, and he complains they're trying to stop resource development. Bristol Bay and Teshakpuk Lake are at the center of controversies over mining and oil and gas development. Environmentalists say they should be protected. The Republican congressmen are demanding the department turn over documentation about its research. They only saw part of the leaked report, and they want the rest of it. The Senate Finance Committee is drafting legislation that would rewrite the structure of the state's tax on natural gas. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The tax on natural gas from the North Slope is currently tied to oil taxes from the state's largest fields, and it's expressed as a ratio in the amount of energy in each fuel. Finance Co-Chair Bert Stedman says that's a fundamental flaw in the tax, and staying with it when gas begins to flow in the line to North American markets will create an expensive problem for the state.
If you have high oil prices, which we currently have, relative to natural gas prices that are low, which we currently have, we have a substantial cross-subsidization, or a dilution effect is another way of putting it, of our revenue stream. And I was rather surprised when we started looking at the magnitude of this potential impact. It could be in the tune of a couple of billion dollars.
Stedman points out that the oil and gas prices are not expected to get closer together for the next 20 years, based on all estimates from government and private sources. And he says the risk is that the tax structure and the $2 billion a year loss to the state could be in effect for the first 10 years gas is flowing. Stedman says the two taxes need to be separated before May 1st. That's when TransCanada will present the gas line to potential shippers in what's called an open season. And those that commit to its use then will have their taxes locked in, unchangeable for 10 years after gas begins to flow. Senators who have followed the Senate Finance Committee hearings for the past 2 weeks are leaning toward Stedman's arguments. Fairbanks Democrat Joe Pascvan says the result of the current tax regime is likely to lead to the state's losing 100% of its production tax and losing 100% of its royalty revenue.
The law as it currently exists puts Alaska at risk of being plundered. And without changes before May 1, 2010, my belief is that essentially we have a third world resource extraction model that will end up being a plunder of Alaska's resources.
Revenue Commissioner Pat Galvin earlier this week presented administration revenue calculations based on higher oil prices. They're similar to those Stedman has produced. However, Governor Parnell called Stedman's presentation of a $2 billion impact on the Treasury as a mythological figure.
Clearly, that coupling issue when the ACES was passed was designed as an incentive. There's been testimony from Commissioner Galvin as to that. So, as Senator Stedman and the Finance Committee, Senate Finance Committee moves forward, they're going to have to take into account whether that impacts the economics of a gas line, because frankly, it very well could if it acted as an incentive.
Stedman says he anticipates his bill will be ready quickly, and it will remove the link between oil and gas. House Finance Co-Chair Mike Hawker shares Stedman's concern, saying the issue is, quote, mission critical for legislative consideration. He says it needs to be dealt with as a single subject, indicating the need for a special session between the regular session's adjournment April 18th and the May 1st open season. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Anchorage curlers describe why they love their oft-ridiculed sport.
My wife was a curler when I met her, and she got me involved. It was kind of like, well, if you want to see me on a couple of nights a week, you need to curl too.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
When Juneau's Valley Youth Club closed late last month, it left more than 60 families looking for new after-school options for their kids. It also exposed what many Juneau parents have long known: child care is hard to come by in the capital city. KTOO's Casey Kelly reports.
It's story time for a group of Glacier Valley Elementary School kindergartners in the Juneau School District's Rally program. Rally offers before and after school care for kids through the fifth grade. Coordinator Wayne Hickson says enrollment is up 2-3% since last fall, when all of the district's elementary schools went to an 8 a.m. start time. He says there are now close to 450 families with at least one child in the program.
Some of it is, I think, people started realizing there's been a big change, obviously, in the elementary level with the new starting in school early and early out. And I think parents are just sorting out how they're going to have their children cared for after school.
Rally was supposed to pick up some of the slack when the Valley Youth Club closed, but Hickson says only 5-7 kids from the club transferred over to Rally.
Parents don't always tell us why they're enrolling, so there's no way to know unless they specifically mention. We try to track a little bit, but as near as I can get to, that's about how many we picked up.
Seven-year-old Linnea Sutek used to go to the Valley Youth Club. Today she's playing computer games at her kitchen table after school.
I died!
Carrie McMullen is Linnea's mom and the former manager of the Valley Youth Club back when it was the Boys and Girls Club of Juneau. Since the club closed, McMullen has had to take off work in order to watch her three children. Her ex-husband has them Monday afternoon and every other Tuesday, but the rest of the week they're home with mom. McMullen says she looked at Rally and private daycare and decided it would be easier on the pocketbook to take care of the kids herself.
For us, and talking to the kids' dad, we just knew that we weren't going to be able to afford the Rally fees for two children. And then the other part is that we have an 11-year-old that's in sixth grade, and he's not quite 12, which is the age that you can leave at home alone.
McMullen also says she was worried about what would happen this summer when the Rally program doesn't offer childcare. Her employer, Center for Community, allows her to make up some of her hours on weekends, and her parents are able to look after the kids when she absolutely has to be at work. But McMullen says her children miss going to the club. 11-year-old Taylor agrees.
There was a lot of other stuff we could do there. Like, we would have friends, we would have art activities, we would have a lot of sports to play, like basketball or football.
Former city manager Kevin Ritchie says, unfortunately, McMullen's situation is not unique. Valley Youth Club operator Juneau Youth Services hired Ritchie to write a report about childcare options in Juneau. What he found is a lot of services being duplicated by various providers.
Because there really wasn't sort of an overarching plan for youth activities in Juneau, you know, there's obviously some, you know, everybody's kind of doing their own thing. And the Boys and Girls Club was really doing something that, you know, the Rally program in the school district is also doing.
Ritchie says both city and school district officials are interested in developing a plan to address Juneau's overall child care situation. And he says meetings will be held early next month to map out how that can be accomplished. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
A spokesman for Senator Lisa Murkowski says there's not much chance the senator herself will make it to Southeast Alaska in the near future to hear public testimony on a controversial land selection bill, and the chance of an official field hearing in the next few weeks is equally as slim. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
Murkowski is sponsoring Senate Bill 881, which would give Sea Alaska Corporation ownership of about 80,000 acres of the Tongass National Forest. Among Sea Alaska's selections are timberlands on Prince of Wales Island and a variety of cultural and wilderness sites around Sitka. Supporters of the legislation say it would mean jobs for parts of Southeast Alaska and that it's long past time to give the regional native corporation land that it's been legally able to select for the past 39 years. Opponents are concerned the bill could have ill effects on the environment within the Tongass and could limit public access to fishing and recreation areas. Sea Alaska says it's not planning developments on the cultural sites it's selected, nor is it planning to limit public access. Several communities, including Sitka and Petersburg, have officially asked the senator to hold local field hearings on the bill with members of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. Murkowski spokesman Robert Dillon.
You know, we understand that the desire for a official field hearing, and that could be done in the future. We're not taking that possibility off the table. It's just that because of the timeliness of this issue, you know, we want to get up there quickly, and an official field hearing can't be put on that quickly. We can't turn that around, so we'll do a town hall meeting.
Murkowski's office will send two staffers to the March 12th Sitka meeting, which will come at the end of visits to other Southeast communities in the days prior. Andrew Tomes of the Sitka Conservation Society says Murkowski should be in the room.
Senator Murkowski has been working closely with Sea Alaska for a number of years now on this legislation, and she knows it's important for the region, it's going to have a big effect on the region, and I think it's only fair that she works as closely with the communities to hear their concerns.
Again, Murkowski spokesman Robert Dillon.
Unfortunately, you know, due to her busy schedule and having to be on the Hill and voting on issues, she's unable to come up this time.
He says Murkowski will receive and review unedited transcripts from the meetings.
I think the senator understands the passion, you know, behind the concerns, and she knows, you know, she was born in Ketchikan, and this is her area. She knows the area. She knows the people. So, I mean, I think that it's always great if you can have a face-to-face meeting, but it's not always possible.
Dillon says even though a field hearing can't happen in the next few weeks, it's not entirely out of the question at a later date. Bill Wicker, a spokesman for Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee Chairman Jeff Bingaman, says if Murkowski requested a field hearing, Senator Bingaman would be supportive of the idea. The committee held a hearing in Alaska, in Bethel, in August, on renewable energy technology. Tomes, meanwhile, says he hopes the Sitka Town Hall meeting is fruitful.
And I hope that we can all rise to the occasion and deal with this in a way that doesn't create more conflict, and that we can get beyond that and find something that works for the benefit of everyone in the community.
The Sitka Town Hall meeting takes place at 7 p.m. on Friday, March 12th, inside Harrigan Centennial Hall. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering how public transportation benefits them, their businesses, and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, social opportunities, wherever people need to go. With public transportation available, the going is good. Find out more at goodgoingalaska.com. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Mobility Coalition, a nonprofit organization.
Athabascan linguist and tradition bearer Catherine Peter has died at age 92 at her Fairbanks home. Peter was an expert in Athabascan language and culture and the author of a number of books and translations. She began working with the Alaska Native Language Center at the University of Alaska Fairbanks when it started in 1972 and went on to teach the Gwich'in language at the university. Alan Hayton, an adjunct instructor in the Gwich'in language, says he knew her well.
Well, she and my grandfather called each other brother and sister. They were both Quakon originally and from downriver, and were both orphans as well, so they had a connection with each other.
Hayton says Peter's work was invaluable to Gwich'in speakers. Her autobiography won the American Book Award in 1993. Peter's funeral is scheduled for Saturday, and burial will be Monday in Arctic Village. What is it like to attend a high school that's three times larger than your entire village? That's what a group of Shishmaref students found out this week, while some West High students began to learn about the village they'll visit in April. As part of our ongoing series on Native education, KSKA's Len Anderson has more.
There's a lot more students than Zach at home. We only have like 180, I believe, and West have like 2,000 students.
Now that 180, are you going all the way down to kindergarten for that?
Yes.
Renee Guzikuk's first day observation about life at Anchorage's West High School was echoed by classmate Janelle Putaguluk.
The hallways are like really scary because there's a lot of people.
The five Shishmaref students and their teacher, Angie Alston, are visiting Anchorage and West High under the Rose Urban Rural Exchange and its sister school program. Monday evening, the Shishmaref and West High students had just emerged from the Anchorage School Board meeting, where Superintendent Carol Como had introduced them to the board. This particular exchange, at least the Anchorage end of it, came about after West High teacher Mandy Morrell participated last summer in the Tlingit Cultural Camp at CAKE through the Rose Urban Rural Teacher Exchange. That experience made Morrell want her students to also learn about village life.
I teach digital photography at West High School. This is our first group of Photography 2 students. We had them all apply. We're doing it as part of a cultural ambassadorship as well as study in art and photography.
Shishmaref's Alston says much of the first part of the week emphasizes experiencing a big city school.
They get to go to classes and eat dinner with their families and attend sport practices and everything just to see what life is like in urban Alaska.
Apparently, the urban students did a pretty good job guiding their village counterparts. By the end of Tuesday, Renee's blog on the Rose Urban Rural Exchange website described a day consisting of classes, a tour of the Alaska Native Medical Center campus, dinner with her host family, a West High hockey game, and a three-school band concert. Tuesday was great, she concluded, with three exclamation marks. In her blog, Janelle's day was awesome. It appears the exchange has also taught the West High students a bit more about Anchorage. Davide Pine is himself an exchange student from Italy.
I think it's nice what we did on Saturday, that we bring them to the port, and I've never been there before too. Kind of nice to watch it together with exchange students.
In April, the five West High students go to Shishmaref. During their stay in northwest Alaska on the west coast of the Seward Peninsula, they'll immerse themselves in village culture. Sophie Wheatkin-Brown is eager for the hands-on experience.
They told us they'd teach us how to make cuss bucks and maybe carve some rings out of ivory, and so I'm really excited for the arts and crafts part of it. I think that'll be really cool.
Meanwhile, Shishmaref student Henry Jones is planning a taste treat for the Anchorage visitors.
My dad's caribou soup. It's really good.
Morrell says the cultural exchange won't end when the Anchorage students head back home.
We're actually going to culminate in a show in May, a First Friday show at the Tudor Kalati Brothers. So we're going to exhibit sort of through the eyes from Shishmaref students and through the eyes from West students. That'll be coming in May.
The Rose Urban Rural Exchange has arranged these cross-cultural sister school visits since 2000. Its website indicates almost three dozen such trips are occurring this semester throughout the state. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
As the Olympic Games draw to a close, athletes will be taking to the ice this weekend to compete for medals in curling, a sport that some find baffling. But curlers here in Anchorage say the sport is a lifestyle and a good excuse to enjoy a cold beer. From Anchorage, Michelle Thériault has the story.
Ken Baum and his team watch a heavy gray curling rock slide down carefully groomed ice. They're curlers, and they know better than anyone that it's a sport that can be hard to explain.
A cross between shuffleboard and chess is probably the best definition I can think of.
Baum is president of the Anchorage Curling Club. He's a lifelong athlete, plays basketball and softball, and got into the sport at the urging of his wife.
My wife was a curler when I met her, and she got me involved. It was kind of like, well, if you want to see me on a couple of nights a week, you need to curl too.
Initially, the sport was bewildering to Baum, but curling, he says, is hard to master, and that's what keeps him hooked.
Very easy to learn, but it's hard to get good at.
The Anchorage Curling Club now has 130 or so members. They meet several nights a week at their Government Hill facility. Next to two specially groomed curling tracks, there's a comfy clubhouse that feels more like a living room. They also host occasional Bondspiels, where they curl against other teams. This weekend, they'll go up against teams from Fairbanks and Barrow for a Fur Rondi event. It's going to be a marathon.
And we'll start Friday night. We'll curl late into the wee hours of the morning, start again first thing in the morning on Saturday morning, curl to about 3 a.m. on Sunday morning, and then start again Sunday morning. And it finally ends up the championship games, I believe, at 4:30 on Sunday afternoon.
Part of the appeal is a social network that can fill up long, dark winter months. Curling is known for being as much a social event as a sport, and most curling clubs, Anchorage's included, have a bar. Scott Parker is a Louisiana transplant who started curling at the urging of a neighbor. He appreciates this element of the sport.
That doesn't hurt when you can drink a beer. It's one of the few sports you can drink and do at the same time.
Out on the ice, there's no beer, just focus and concentration. Competitors slide a thick stone disc known as a rock across smooth ice, sweeping in front of it to influence its trajectory. The goal? To get the rock as close as possible to the target area.
Nice one.
Curling is primarily a Canadian sport. Of 1.3 million curlers worldwide, 1.1 million are said to be Canadian. Ken Baum says there's a definite contingency in the club.
I haven't met too many Canadians that don't know how to curl, let's put it that way. And we get a lot of transplanted Canadians here, because oil company transfers or this or that to come here that end up curling in the club.
Most of the club members agree that being a curler means putting up with the skepticism of the uninitiated. Scott Parker tends to do a lot of explaining about his hobby.
Oh yeah, they're all asking 1,000 questions and trying to figure out what the difference, in curling is, and why we get attracted to this stupid sport. What do you mean you're out there in the cold on the ice? but it does get to the point where it gets in your blood and you enjoy it, and like I say, it's a real social event.
Baum would like to see curling get a bit more respect.
I wish they'd kind of like quit making fun of it until they try it.
As Anchorage curlers compete in their weekend Bondspiel, Olympic athletes will be playing for gold in Vancouver. Club members hope the exposure will sweep a few new fans in their direction. In Anchorage, I'm Michelle Terrio.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Len Anderson and Michelle Terrio in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business with data transfer speeds up to Gig E. ACS, connecting Alaska companies to each other and the rest of the world. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.